Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Can charity solve the problem of Gaza?
The solution is more than humanitarian in almost every one of these situations now.
They merely provide like a sticking plaster solution to our challenges.
Where in our history have we gone round bucket in hand? This is kind of like the cycle that our charities are stuck in. And until I think we're not brave enough.
Some Muslim charities overspent on salaries, for example. Some Muslim charities, they're leaking money.
If there is one criticism that I do have of our sector, and I don't have a lot, by the way, do any of our charities put 5% aside, 1% aside for lobbying?
It's high net worth, we mean rich people, do we? Every year, the list of beleaguered Muslim countries and people increases, and with it, the demand for charity. We are used to giving in sadaqah, and our kindness as a community is rarely matched. The Muslim community in the UK alone gives upwards of £1 billion in charity, much of which goes abroad. Now, the situation in Gaza has once again led to a determined effort by many to contribute to charitable causes. As Ramadan comes, inevitably our minds and hearts will turn to those in our ummah that live this month without anything but the clothes on their back. Such is the parlous state of the Muslim Ummah. But does charity really work? What is charity? Is building a water well, however satisfying, the way to reconstruct some of the Muslim world? Are there better ways by which we can use our money without compromising on our commitments to our people? To help us understand this subject, we have invited on to the Thinking Muslim a charity insider, probably someone the most qualified to help us untangle this topic. Kashif Shabir has over 15 years' experience in the social impact and charity sector. He was until recently the CEO of Muslim Aid, one of the oldest faith-based NGOs in the country. He has worked for and helped found several Muslim charities, including the National Zakat Foundation and Charity Right, and held leadership positions at some of the largest mainstream charities, including as head of knowledge and learning at Oxfam and the British Red Cross as part of their strategic change management team. Kashif sits on several advisory boards, including Bond, the largest network of organizations working in international development. He currently leads the social impact advisory at Qadr Financial, where he works with charities, family offices, and government agencies to improve their effectiveness and maximizing their social impact. Kashif Shabir, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, and welcome to the Thinking Muslim.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Honor and pleasure, and huge fan of the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's really wonderful to have you with us, Kashif. Now, Kashif, we met a few weeks back at a cafe in South London. I never go to South London, so it was an experience for me.
I think it was both.
We got speaking about the charity sector and Gaza. And of course, Gaza remains a real problem in the Muslim Ummah. So I suppose the question to start with is, does charity really work? Can charity solve the problem of Gaza?
The The answer to that question is no. Not the way that we do charity right now. No. And that's for a number of reasons. The problems like Gaza, or the situations like Gaza that exist in the world today, are just so much more complicated geopolitically than maybe humanitarian situations that we've had in the past. Syria, Yemen, you pick them, all of them. Where our charity, I think both the definition of the word charity that comes out of this, and also the way in which our charity is, I guess, disproportionately balanced only on the humanitarian side, is probably not an adequate solution to solving a problem like Gaza. Right. And we saw that obviously with, unfortunately, the stopping of aid trucks when even organizations like the UN were trying to get in and stuff, and the aid trucks were held up at the borders and stuff. So you can see that, you know, even if you gave hundreds of millions of pounds at that point in humanitarian aid, because of the lack of advocacy, diplomacy, or whatever you want to call it, the political will to change the situation there as well, that humanitarian aid isn't going to get where it's meant to get to. So I think there's two reasons why. One is, the way that we've interpreted charity from an Islamic point of view into this Western way, I guess, of how charity is defined. And this disproportionate amount of giving that goes into humanitarian side, which absolutely has to be done. Please don't misinterpret what I'm saying. But the solution is more than humanitarian in almost every one of these situations now globally.
Syria or any of the Rohingya or any of these Muslim countries.
Yeah, I mean, we've been to Rohingya as part of the charity work that, projects we've been involved in. It's a very political situation. The fact that, you've got the Rohingya in one part of Bangladesh, they don't want them to move around to other parts of Bangladesh because it's starting to affect the economy.
Yeah,
people want to find work. Rohingya is a good example, actually. I mean, there's actually an island that the Bangladesh government and the NGOs have built offshore. It was 3 hours. On a military boat, from Chittagong, where the idea is to house the Rohingyas now, and it can house up to, I think, 100,000 or something like that. I can't remember. But the Rohingyas don't want to go there because it's isolated. Nothing, everything has to be brought in, food and so on and so forth. So that's just another example. Obviously, when Syria was happening and Russia was on one side and at that time Russia was blocking the aid coming into Syria. So all of these issues now are just a lot more complicated than they were, and they require more than just humanitarian effort to solve them.
So can I ask you about Gaza? We know that the West have now in effect defunded Gaza, UNRWA, the chief UN organization responsible for distributing aid to Gaza. So on a practical level, I mean, we're talking on the 7th of February. How does aid get through?
How does aid get through? I think some of these developments, I think even on an international scale, with organizations like UNRWA, are quite unprecedented. You've got a United Nations body being obviously accused of aiding the attacks in Palestine, and because of that, funding of I think the number was around 400 million from the countries that have withdrawn funding. Really? 400 million plus.
Wow.
That they've got a shortfall of, and you have to remember UNRWA's responsibility is not just the Gaza Strip. They are responsible for the refugee camps, doctors, teachers, schools, hospitals in dozens of countries. And so they the head of UNRWA mentioned I think yesterday, the day before, that I think 30,000 UN employees are now at risk of not getting paid. But to answer your question, how is aid getting through? Look, UNRWA is the largest organization there. They haven't shut them down. Their funding has obviously been withdrawn by the major countries. They haven't been thrown out of the country. So they are still working. Other NGOs are still working. And there is still avenues of aid that is getting through to the borders. They have been opened to some extent.
Yeah.
Obviously not to the level that we would like. Mm. But NGOs are working there, the larger charities especially. And the aid is trickling through. But obviously the intention seems to be at least that to try to restrict that trickle to as small as possible.
So you suggested the largest charities. You mean the Muslim charities are working? Like, do Muslim charities still distribute within Gaza?
Yes, they do. Muslim and non-Muslim.
Yeah. Give me some of those charities, for
example. Well, without mentioning names, that most of the larger charities will have partners in that work in Palestine. So a lot of international charities have been banned from working in Gaza and Palestine for a very long time. So they don't work there under their own names, you know. So any of the larger charities that you want, anyone from Islamic Relief, Muslim Aid, anyone that you can mention.
Yeah.
Of their own accord, they can't work under those names. So they normally work under partners that they have on the ground. And they have been. Muslim Aid has had an office there for, I think, 30-odd years or stuff. Islamic Relief, probably the same.
Mm.
And most of these, the normal charities. So they have offices on the ground. Mm. They work through partners. So that's one thing why, you know, maybe the listeners don't know already that's always been a restriction.
Really?
You know, if you have Islam or Muslim or something to do, a faith-based, in your name and in the way that you serve the people, then they've always had to work around those to get aid into Gaza, number one.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, Gaza's controlled, the in and outs of Gaza is controlled by the Israeli government. So all of those charities that work there have to have permission from the Israeli government on where they can distribute, et cetera, and who they get to. Mm. But yes, they do. And all of those charities probably still have access to some level of distributing that cash. It's it is just not at the level that the people need right now.
Mm.
The ones that have access, yes, there's no doubt that the prioritization is given to the registered charities, the larger charities that are there, starting with the UN charities and then working your way down.
Right.
And that's Muslim and non-Muslim. So those that are collecting money for Palestine, my advice, I guess, is that in situations like Gaza, you would stick to the structured and largest charities, only because they are normally registered. Even if they can't get the food in, if they can't get the humanitarian aid in today, they'll get it in tomorrow, and they'll be the first ones to be allowed in to get it in.
So let me understand that. So are you saying that if I wanted to give money to Gaza, it probably would be better for me to give it to a larger Muslim charity who would have partners on the ground and who would have communications with, say, UNRWA or Oxfam,
exactly,
rather than a smaller charity?
I think in this situation, for sure. Right. For sure. Smaller charities, absolutely, our brothers and sisters that run those have their place. Yeah. Sometimes they can get to places where others cannot. But I don't, in this situation, I wouldn't risk that. Personally,
Kashif, you've got a lot of experience of the general charity sector. You've worked in Muslim charities and non-Muslim charities. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the claims made against Muslim charities is that they merely provide like a sticking plaster solution to our challenges. I mean, how would you respond to that claim?
I can understand why. I think in the modern context, why people will say that.
Yeah.
But before I think I answer that question, I think we need to be very appreciative that of the critical role, especially the Muslim charities play, both in our faith and in our communities. Living in non-Muslim lands or a majority non-Muslim lands, they are playing a critical role in the collection and distribution of our charity work. Like, quite frankly, places now that we can give to... that me and you by ourselves, if we couldn't collect our funds together and distribute in those areas, we wouldn't have the same impact. Mm-hmm. But like, we wouldn't, right? I mean, sending a couple of £100,000 into one of these countries versus me or you sending our individual Zakat donations to those countries definitely has a more impact, and they have more sway, quite frankly. They can work with the governments, they can establish longer term programs, etc. So they are critical. They are critical in both, you know, collecting our zakat and distributing our zakat because of the way where we live and how we now live in modern society.
Yeah.
But I think the question is now: are they still not fit for purpose? I guess is a bit strong, but are they still set up in a way to be most effective?
Right.
And I think that's where I would probably challenge that: is the charity sector now set up in a way, or has it moved far enough along that evolution to address the current challenges that we have?
So explain that. So what should they be doing that maybe they're not doing now to resolve some of the longer term problems?
You mentioned, I think you touched upon the longer term development stuff. It's very hard, for example, in the charity sector, in our and with our audiences, the blame is not only for our charities, right? We tend to be quite emotional people. We react to emergencies,
yeah.
and most of our charities raise that money on the back of those emergencies. Mm. If you look at fundraising initiatives, and fundraising in any of our charities, and maybe even non-Muslim charities, that when there's an emergency, we'll all latch onto that emergency,
right.
and off the back of that emergency,
earthquake last year,
exactly,
in Turkey,
exactly, yeah.
Right.
I mean, and the Palestinian cause, just FYI,
yeah.
I mean, you can almost guarantee, anyone who's working in the Muslim charity sector,
yeah.
can almost guarantee that around about Ramadan time, something's going to happen in Palestine. I don't know if that's on purpose by the Israeli authorities, etc. But normally around Ramadan time, something will happen, you'll get a bump, and suddenly your appeals gets shifted around the Palestinian cause.
Yeah.
That then has a knock-on effect on your rest of the fundraising.
Right.
It's easier to raise money for emergencies than it is for, quite frankly, longer term projects.
Right.
I can report back to Jalal on his donation and what impact it had in an emergency. It bought X food packs, it bought this and that, medical equipment, etc. I built a house even. It's quite easy to report back on those things, and the figures look really good on annual reports and donor reports. Mm. What's harder to report on and takes longer as impact is the longer term stuff.
Right.
If I told you, you know, contribute to this climate change issue, if I can give an example, it might be
please.
Easier to understand.
Yeah.
Places like Bangladesh, we've used Bangladesh twice now, but places like Bangladesh have monsoon floods, or parts of India have a monsoon flood every year.
Mm.
Right? Every time the coast where people make their living or fishing, etc., rice, they need that rain, and so they build, you know, these houses or what we would, I guess you can't really call them houses, but dwellings along the coastline,
yeah.
get wiped away every year.
Right.
Right. Now, obviously, the climate change issue is becoming a thing. Right. So like, if we're not talking about climate change, every year you're collecting money to build those houses for these people.
Yeah.
You build those houses next year, knowing, as a charity, knowing
yeah.
that next year these are going to be demolished.
Yes.
Now, either you can now say, okay, you know what? We need to step back. We can't carry on collecting money for these houses. Let's tell people about climate change and how this is affecting things, and join the climate change lobby and educate our donors on this thing. That's a lot of work. It's much harder to do.
Yeah.
And then trying to report back on that. I mean, you can imagine, like, so Jalal's giving me £100
yeah.
and he says, okay, I'm convinced you're right. We need to work on this climate change stuff.
Yeah.
And I finally get £100 out of Jalal
yeah.
for this climate change. And now I have to report back to him, like, what we've done on climate change.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really hard. Whereas you give me £100 and say, give it to me, Palestine, I can say to him immediately, I bought you 2 food packs. They cost me 50 quid each and they're going to feed a family of 5.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So this is kind of like the cycle that our charities are stuck in, and until I think we're not brave enough
yeah.
to address and say, okay, you know what, we might lose out on this emergency.
Right.
We're not going to put Palestine out there
yeah.
because we're focused on the long-term solution. Until we're brave enough and our charities are brave enough to do that, I think we're going to still continue in that cycle.
So I do want to talk about the longer term solutions, because I think we need to elaborate on what that is. But before we get there, just compare, please. You've worked in the non-Muslim or non-faith-based sector. You've worked with Oxfam and British Red Cross, I think. Compare that sector with the Muslim charity sector. Like, what are the, where do they come together and where do they divide?
Yeah, it's a question that people ask me often. Yeah. Like, oh, you know what? It must be better. It must be better in
that's in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. It must be better because they're bigger, they're richer, and quite frankly, and
more organized, maybe.
More organized and stuff.
Yeah.
And the truth is, and the normal response I give to people is the problems are the same. The numbers are just different.
Really?
You know, so sometimes there's an extra zero at the end of that problem. Sometimes there's a zero less.
Yeah.
You know, the salaries aren't any better than the Muslim charity sector. So people that think, oh, you know what, you're in Oxfam, so you must have earned a lot more. It wasn't. It wasn't a lot more. I had a massive team in Oxfam. Probably the biggest team I've managed outside of when I was a CEO. And I know how much I paid those people. And then I went into the Muslim charity sector and the differences in that regard wasn't so much. If you look at the scandals and the issues that some of these larger charities have gone into over the last X years, and not mentioning any names, I mean, they're horrendous. You know, they're horrendous. You can't possibly even put them on the same scale as the kind of things that we accuse our Muslim charities of.
Give me some examples. Not with charities, but just examples of what scandals are we talking
about. If you pick up... So what in the Muslim charity sector, what is the biggest thing that we've kind of experienced as a sector, or even with our biggest charities? We've never been accused of running away with money, right? As a sector, we're not known for that. We are more frugal, quite frankly, than the majority of the sector. Yeah. We are more generous as a community than any other sector, even with that. But for some reason, our problems get highlighted a lot more.
Right.
Whereas, you know, quite frankly, I mean, it's public knowledge, so we can mention some of them. I mean, you know, Oxfam got done in Haiti for some atrocious sexual misconduct, and you know, and the donations fell like tens of millions of pounds per month. You know, from when that scandal broke out, the government contracts were cancelled. By the way, I was at Oxfam when it was like £800 million, right, or £600 million. Half of that money was coming from government contract. It was huge. Imagine half of your income, like, you know, you can't now bid for government tenders, because that's how government gives out charity money, right? So when government says we give out a whole bunch of money, they put out tenders, and then charities, obviously, you know,
like, so international development fund goes through charities.
You normally like apply for that. So for example, the government says we want to spend £10 million empowering women in Pakistan to start their own businesses.
Yeah.
They'll say who's the specialist in that, and then they'll put out the thing, and charities that think they can deliver that program, they'll apply for that funding. That's how the government giving works. But my point is that a lot of that money came to Oxfam through that got cancelled. And so, I mean, if not, and then they had a massive restructure, like pretty much the whole of the executive team left, and the CEO left, the vice, all of these people left.
We don't have anything like that in the Muslim charity sector, really.
Nowhere close. I would say not like that. I would say nowhere close. But I think because charity, or, you know, the quote unquote charity, is so much more to the Muslim faith than it is, I think, to maybe others, we do hold our charities to a higher standard. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. All I'm saying is that I don't believe that non-Muslim charities or non-faith-based charities have managed to set any standard that I think the Muslim charities should say, oh, you know what, we should be more like that. And the Muslim community should definitely not think that these problems exist. And just on the final point, that, I mean, if you want to go on the Charity Commission website, you can sign up to their newsletters. on what charities are being investigated or inquiries have been opened on a regular basis.
Yeah.
It's public knowledge. They have to make it public.
Mm.
I know that from my opinion. And you can look for yourself how many Muslim charities get picked up versus non-Muslim charities. It's not even comparable.
So let's talk about that, because in the community, there is an impression at least that some Muslim charities overspend on salaries, for example, or some Muslim charities, they're leaking money, or there are, I don't know, their service, what they claim they're doing in a place actually turns out not to be what they're doing. So there is a general hesitancy, maybe in some circles, at least in Muslim community, towards the Muslim charity sector. Are you suggesting that hesitancy is exaggerated and probably not warranted?
I'm not going to say it's not warranted, but definitely exaggerated.
Really?
Like I said, I think mostly because I think we hold ourselves to a much higher standard.
Mm.
And I think the ultimately how we've confined ourselves to the definition of charity and the Western ideals on what charity means.
Yeah.
I think is problematic. We can't. There's a certain level of trust that you at some point have to discharge to the person who's distributing that money for you. If you've decided that you can't do this yourself, which most of us can't, for every reason. If you can, great.
Yeah.
But most of us have discharged that duty to a charity by giving that donation. If that charity has said that, look, here's, you know, we're a registered charity and we have to comply by all of these protocols and procedures of the charity law. By the way, the UK, just as a side note, the UK's Charity Commission and charity law is by far one of the most stringent regulatory bodies in the world.
Mm.
In the world.
Right.
Right. I mean, my first advice to someone who normally wants to start up a charity is don't do it. Right. It's a lot of work. Right.
Yeah.
To meet those things.
And do we need those smaller charities, by the way?
We? Do we need them? no, I do we need them?
Yeah.
Of course, look, I would question whether we need all of them. I mean, all charities started off small. You have to remember that as
true.
Well.
Yeah.
I think the challenge we have is, yes, I think we do have a problem where it is probably the only sector, you know, where an individual is unhappy about another charity working and then decides, I'm going to just start my own.
Right.
And you would never do that for any other business. I wouldn't go to a mechanic and because he couldn't fix my car, I'd say, you know what, that's it. I'm just going to become a mechanic and fix it myself. Right. Or, you know, you go to a doctor and you have a bad experience and you're like, you know what, forget that. I'm going to do that myself. But for some reason in the charity sector, we tend to feel that we can do that. And I think the distinction I would make where it is a good idea when it's not a good idea. If you are going to start a charity where you believe you are going to tackle a distinct problem in a distinct way that no one else is doing.
Uh-huh. Give me an example. Like,
I mean, some great examples. I mean, like I was talking to a good friend of mine. He's a CEO of another charity at the moment. So I'm not going to mention it. But he's saying, look, I'm going to set up a separate charity and we're just going to focus on cataracts.
Oh.
Right? I can do it faster, quicker, cheaper than any of these guys can do it. But we're going to just focus on this cataracts.
Right.
You understand? I'm going to build this network up. We've got this specialization. I'm going to build on this specialization because of competencies that I've built up, experience I've built up in this area. And then we're going to outsource that service to the big charities, right? We're going to say, look, if you want to do anything to do with cataracts, you come to us, which makes complete sense.
Right.
Because Muslim Aid might not want to be a cataract specialist, right? Islamic Relief might not want to do that. Like, do you understand? We don't have to build our own teams. We can say, okay, these guys do it really well and did it really efficiently.
Yeah.
It makes sense. If you're going to... So that's when I think it makes sense. Absolutely makes sense. But if you're going to say, I'm going to start up a charity because I'm upset or I believe I can do it, I'm going to do the same thing that Islamic Relief or Muslim Aid or any of these big guys do because the admin is too high or they're inefficient or I believe they're corrupt, etc. And I'm going to do it. What normally happens, Jalal, I can tell you, because those charities normally come to me for advice, is it does work up to a certain point. It does work. You are normally cheaper until you hit that first million, £2 million.
Mm.
in donations, you are more efficient because you can get volunteers to do a lot of the work. You can strike deals. You can get into places that other, maybe the bigger charities find hard to get to. But once you start hitting that 1 million, 2 million pound mark, and you have to now meet protocols, now you have to put processes in place, now you have to hire a proper finance person to do your books, you need to get an auditor to audit your account, and now you see the cost is escalating, then those people normally end up realizing that, oh, actually, I realize now why those guys were charging more, because now I have to pay for all of this stuff, which I didn't have to do when I was raising a couple of hundred quid, a couple of thousand quid. And that's when the inefficiencies creep in. You know, that's when the inefficiencies creep in. So, yes, if you've got a focus, if there's an area that you're going to do and no one else is doing that, and you can provide a value add to that thing, absolutely start. You know, you can bring those experience people. But if you're just doing it because you're, quite frankly, cheesed off with someone else, I think, you know, you need to relook at your intentions and see, okay, what can I do to influence that? And then rather than split the thing. And just to finish off with an example I was in Bangladesh when the Bangladesh floods happened. And then an earthquake happened in Pakistan, and my team, at the time I was at Muslim Aid, the campaigns had kicked off in the UK to collect money for these floods. And unfortunately, a few of the smaller charities, they launched their campaigns and they literally used each other's pictures. So you're getting these WhatsApp messages and email campaigns, and they'd used, so it was clear that we just looked like a mess. We just looked like an absolute, you know, we just looked like a mess, like unorganized, unstructured. Whereas in Bangladesh, where I was sitting at the time, they were very organized. The government was very organized. Okay, you know what? They, you know, they divide up the sections of relief into in the, you know, the camps into quadrants, and charities are responsible for a certain amount depending on how much you could do. They assign those quadrants, and you're looking at these campaigns, and I was like, you know, it just looked like a total mess. So I think that's where unfortunately there's that duplication of effort and waste of resource. Could we have come together, especially on the big emergencies? And this is an idea, by the way, I'll say on your podcast, that, you know, could we put together something like DEC?
That's the emergency umbrella organization.
Yeah. Right. So what DEC do, again, it's a good maybe education for ourselves. So DC Disasters Emergency Committee have 12 members. Islamic Relief Fund is the only Muslim charity in there at the moment. But they have these members, but they just run appeals. They don't actually do the work. They run appeals. When there's an appeal to be run, like Ukraine, for example, like Afghanistan when it happened, so they'll get permission to run these adverts on TV from the broadcasters. So they have these deals with the broadcasters they can run. And then normally there's some government match. And then they give that money to the charities that are members of DEC. Right. And then you have to meet certain criteria and pay a certain amount of money to be a member of DEC. But you'll get that back from there. The thought process that had gone through my mind when I was in Bangladesh at that time is all of the smaller charities, and even the bigger ones, quite frankly, when there's a disaster like that in a Muslim-majority country, why couldn't we have a DEC kind of appeal where all of those people put in a certain amount of cash and we can run mainstream campaigns on mainstream media, and then when you get the money in, those that are specialized in delivering that work could divvy up the money and do it that way.
And why don't we do that?
Why don't we do that? Why don't we do that?
Are we just too divided to do that? Is that the criticism?
Yeah, I think you've been involved in a number of grassroots projects, and so have I on different levels. But yeah, unfortunately, if there is one criticism that I do have of our sector, and I don't have a lot, by the way. I think on the whole we're very good at what we do, and we have sincere people that have, quite frankly, taken, you know, huge sacrifices to work in that sector. They can make money somewhere else quite easily. It's a sector that is run by, quite frankly, a lot of selfless individuals. However, we are just very bad at working together. Even as at CEO level, I tried, and other CEOs, I'm sure, have tried to, even for the purposes of PR, to show that, you know, we can collaborate and execute on a project together, and we weren't able to. I'm not saying that we don't talk to each other. There's a massive amount of communication. There's forums now set up, Muslim Charities Forum, others, that where charity leaders come together. But it seems like that's where the collaboration, unfortunately, and obviously the evidence is in our work, that we haven't managed to execute on the ground in a united way. I mean, I'm sure part of that has to do with egos. Part of that probably has to do with, like, you know, people, our own charities being afraid of the reputation, maybe of being associated with another brand or with another name. Losing donors, obviously, is a big one. So, you know, if we do it with them, would we lose our funding, or would we lose our donors to those? And people have done that, unfortunately, to each other. Some people still do that online and compete with each other's names and try to the truth is that hasn't happened at any respectable level.
Akash, about the start of the show, I mentioned, I think it was from the Ayan Institute, this figure of 1 billion Muslims spend a billion in charity every year, disproportionately probably more than other communities, I would imagine, in the UK. How accurate is that figure from where you sit, and does most of that money go to Muslim charities?
The figure is between 500 million and £1 billion a year.
Yeah,
every year.
Wow.
is given, and that's just the UK, right? So, listeners and yourself know that if you add up the income of all of our top charities and the media ones, we come nowhere near that figure.
Really?
So where's that money going? The technical term for it is unstructured or structured giving, right? Structured giving is coming through some sort of vehicle like a charity, and they donate your money or they take your money and take that amana, take that trust and donate it on your behalf. Unstructured is, you know, remittances, Jalal's sending money to people directly himself, and as a community, you can easily calculate that most of that money is still very much unstructured giving, which is good and bad. The bad part is obviously then just like anything else, when your giving is unstructured and distributed wider, the impact of that giving is drastically reduced, you know. So, and you can see it. I mean, we are recognized as the most generous community in this country, maybe globally, but definitely in this country, recognized as the most generous community. But and with the amount of money that we give, which is miraculous, by the way, because socially, economically, we're at the bottom, and we give the most, which is subhanAllah. Just a testament to our faith and to the community. But we don't, as regards permanent infrastructure or awqaf or establishments, we don't really have a lot to show for it apart from our masajid, which quite frankly we can't even take credit for, which was probably done a generation before us.
Yes.
I mean, that's how much we give. Most of it is unstructured. And because it's unstructured, we probably are not having the best impact that we probably could have, to solve some of these problems.
So I want to talk about the impact we could be having. And of course, you and I, and all Muslims in this country, we give charity because there is a very strong Islamic basis behind giving. So from Islamic history, from the Islamic text, like, what is charity? I mean, it may sound like a simple question, but how do you understand charity from an Islamic perspective?
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Yeah, we probably should have started with that, with that question. I think a lot of what we're seeing in the Muslim charity sector is because we've tried to, and we continue to try to fit ourselves into the mold of what Western societies have described as charity.
Right.
And we know from our faith, and I'm not the best person to ask what charity means in Islam. And mashallah, you've had other guests on the program that are much, much better and have defined that better than myself. But what I can say from my limited knowledge, and inshallah, please, you can contribute, is we know what charity, we know the different ways that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam and Allah Subhanahu wa Ta'ala has described charity and sadaqah in the Quran, right? Look at the variation that we have. The holisticness of what we talk about when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala quote unquote mentions charity, you know. I can only mention charity. Arabic English is quite frankly my natural language. So I have to use the word charity as well. But even saying every time I say it, I'm like, you know, I'm doing a disservice. The Prophet is describing charity as a smile. The Prophet ﷺ is collecting charity to go to war. The Prophet ﷺ is collecting charity for the orphan. The Prophet ﷺ is collecting charity for or giving charity in the ways of goods and services. The Prophet ﷺ and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are using sadaqah and zakat and prayer and charity in simultaneously in verses of the Quran. I mean, just in those few examples, look at the vastness of what Allah and His Messenger are referring to as charity. And we've brought it down to calculating 2.5% of whatever you're owed. And how do we do that on stocks and shares? Mm-hmm. How do we do that, you know, compared to over an equity fund versus your pension pot? And, you know, the gold that I'm wearing, do I need to pay on that? Or can I say that? That's what we've reduced it down to. Mm-hmm. And so then you're looking at that £1 billion figure. And I'm saying to you, well, you know, what are we actually collecting and what we're actually distributing, and what the Prophet and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala saying is about charity. That what it just the whole ecosystem, unfortunately, has been designed around a donation point of view, whereas historically the Islamic world has never worked, never from my understanding and my reading of Islamic history, we've never done charity like this.
So how did it work?
I mean, you can see. Look, there, of course, the Prophet asked for money, and the companions after him. But look at the way that our establishments have built up. The largest institutions in the world that exist today, education wise, hospital wise, and stuff like that. Especially places like Turkey, Pakistan, India. You can see universities were oak-off. You know, were gifts that were given either by the Sultan or by rich people. Or people that were to do, and they will take care of those things. Now, people will say, oh, no, but that was because there was an Islamic state. That's not true. If you look at some of those people that established these things, they were outside of the Islamic state. Mm-hmm. They were personal endowments.
The hospitals and schools were not state endeavors. They were...
No, cult, absolutely. Right. I mean, look at who donated. I was lucky enough to be invited to Istanbul last week. And people love talking about the history of Istanbul. The majority of those masajid were not built by the state. The big ones were, absolutely. Right, you know, we know about the Blue Mosque and almost bankrupting the state. But the truth is that the majority of them were built by the viziers or someone who worked in the court or some other person of the... They might have had to get permission to build that mosque. Madrasas. And by the way, the madrasas in Istanbul, I'm sure you know more than mine. These were not where me and you went just to learn our Quran and chip. These were places where if you wanted to get the top jobs in the judiciary and so, you had to go through these madrasas. I.e., they were places of, like, you know, you had to go through those to get to the elite of society. most of those madrasas were privately funded institutions. Right. You know, where did poor people go? Where in our history have anyone from the government or from individuals, charities, gone round bucket in hand, saying, "Jalal, there's, you know, you need to give us money to help that poor person over there." It just never happened. Mm-hmm. It never happened. Unfortunately, we have ways to give. I mean, people mention Al-Kaf a lot, and alhamdulillah, mashallah, there has been now a revival of that through some of the organizations.
Explain Al-Kaf to our listeners, yeah.
Al-Kaf is a plural of waqf. Waqf is the closest thing in English terminology is a permanent endowment.
Right.
So this is Jalal saying that, look, this cup, I am going to give in the service of this ummah permanently. It no longer now remains the property of Jalal. Mm-hmm. It is now permanently the property of service. Anything that is generated from this is used to give back to the ummah or the thing itself. So it could be a building, for example, right. And that building is an Al-Kaf, or it could be something, the rent from that building, and that is a permanent Al-Kaf. Right. So that's what, in modern terminology, that's now a cash kind of waqf. So the cash is something that is the work, maybe not the asset itself. But in the olden days, it was mostly an asset. You know, you gave something over, you know, that laptop that you're using, you'll say, look, this can't be used for anything else except for a thing. And in perpetuity,
yeah.
Whatever the word is, yeah. You know, that would be used for the cause that it was endowed upon. So right. If it was a hospital or service, to the community and stuff. So yeah. that's a permanent endowment on what we call waqf. In the Muslim world, you see these largely in the form of universities, schools, hospitals, and wells. I mean, you know, in charity world, yeah. I think you might touch upon that. But yeah, water wells, you know, is considered to be stuff like that. Yeah.
So let's talk about that. You've just described really very evocatively charity being a broader, more comprehensive ideal in Islam than just bucket in hand and giving money to an emergency, right? So just lay out for me the possibilities. Like, imagine a world where Kashif was designing a charity, in inverted commas, that looked in this comprehensive way, and the consumer, you know, people like me who are, you know, who were less obsessed about just putting money into emergency and thinking about the long term. Mm. What type of charity structure would you think about establishing?
These are really good conversations, and especially like my work now with high net worth and people that want to set up their own foundations.
High net worth, we mean rich people, do we?
Very rich people. Really? Like you actually have high net worth, and now you have VHNW, so you have very high net worth. Really? Right? And I think there's an ultra as well.
Oh, yeah.
So and charities, you find them differently, right? Or they say, so high net worth could be like, depending on who you work with, like it could be between 5 and 10K,
yeah.
But then very high net worth can be a million, and then ultra high net worth is when you're talking about tens, maybe of millions.
Wow.
But anyway, that's just terminology. But yeah, high net worth, rich people.
Yeah.
And you can see the trend, especially in the non-Muslim side, as well, the Zuckerbergs and the Gates Foundation and all that, like where these people have gone into this private philanthropy, i.e. we're going to just set up our own foundations and stuff. So my point of bringing that up is that those conversations are now very much happening in those circles.
Yes.
Because giving away like £1 million or giving away tens of millions of pounds is not like me and you giving away a couple of £1,000, giving a couple of £100. You could actually have some real impact. And strategic thinking around that is fundamentally always critical, and I'm trying to position myself in that space now, because those individuals are more likely to listen about strategy and having a strategic impact than the individual donor,
because they've made their money through some sort of process.
Exactly. So right. they'll understand marketing, they'll understand IT, they'll understand, but why? Because they've spent money, they know what it takes to make that kind of money and do it properly. Yeah. So but to answer your question is yes. Our charity historically and especially amongst the larger charities in the UK and quite frankly in the West altogether has largely been disproportionately on the humanitarian side. Mm. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for example, has given us seven categories of zakat, as we know in the Quran. We're largely covering one and two all the time. Whatever the disaster is, whatever the problem is, we're collecting for one and two, right? Now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that you should give to the traveler, you should give to the people whose hearts are inclined, you should give to X, Y, and Z. There's a reason for that.
Yeah.
We know that every verse in the Quran has a purpose for that verse.
Mm.
It's a book of guidance. It's a book of instruction. So if it was meant to be just the two categories that we're supposed to give to, then he would have mentioned two categories.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He mentions, on top of that, he's mentioned a million other ways to give sadaqah.
Mm.
Has he not? Right? So you can, but we are so fixated on those first two categories, and knowing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, out of his infinite wisdom, has given us those other five because he knows that's what it takes to run this, quite frankly, how to run this world and to solve its problems.
Mm.
If everyone done that, then those things that we're doing now, maybe that's a lot of those things we won't see. Yeah. But we've ignored what he has said about those other things and concentrated mostly, I'm saying. So if I was going to design it, and normally when you're sitting down, especially with, like I said, these quote-unquote rich people, you can explain to them that, look, you've got £1 million here that we need to give away,
yeah,
right? You want to solve, let's just say, the Gaza thing, right? What does it actually take to solve this Gaza problem? We need some money going to humanitarian, absolutely. Let's say 20% of your thing goes to that. Or actually, even better, let's say only your zakat goes to the humanitarian side because we don't want to get into the controversies of what those other five categories mean in this day and age. Fine, you don't want to do that. Let's just give your zakat to the humanitarian side. All this other money that you've got to give away, why don't we look at some of the other ways that we can solve this problem? Who's paying for lobbying groups to change the story around Gaza to get those trucks in? So those humanitarian aids that you're giving to, who's going to open the gates for those? How do we open those gates? What's the theory of change behind that? Oh, actually, we need to do this, 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 and this. Who's funding that? No one, right? The media, right? Now, some people say that, oh, that's what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala means by the hearts that are inclined, etc. Maybe you could influence the media by doing X, Y, and Z. Fine. You don't want to give your zakat there. Give your sadaqah there. If your ultimate goal is to help Gaza, you need to look at that theory of change. Sorry, I'm using theory of change because that's what we use in the sector.
Fantastic.
I.e., what does it take to actually create change?
Yeah.
And then distribute that money according to the things that you actually need to create that change process.
Yeah.
And I think you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out that I need to split my money across these other causes, you know. And there are people there that are doing that work now, really good organizations that are lobbying our politicians for to stand up and stick to the ground. I mean, we saw trickles of that, you know, with some of these ministers stepping down and not voting for those that didn't want to vote for the ceasefire and stuff. And they stepped down. They did step down. Now, you can argue, oh, they were going to do that anyway and stuff. But the truth is, there was some pressure happening there. The marches. Who's paying for the marches, man? When we met at those marches, I mean, a few hundred thousand people every time. There's a stage set up there. And quite frankly, as a charity worker, every time I see that stage, I'm like, who's paying for it?
Yeah.
Like, am I paying? Like, I'm not paying for it because I haven't put anything in that thing. But if we're not prepared to look at these other ways along that theory of change to have that impact, then quite frankly, don't expect change to happen. I don't blame the charities.
Yeah.
Because you're just paying them for food parcels. They're delivering those food parcels. And next year, they're going to come back to you and ask for more food parcels because that problem is still there because you've neglected all these other ways that... I'm not making this stuff up, right?
Oh.
There's theories of change for all of these areas. And you would argue that those people on the other side know what they are and they've done a very good job at blocking us off. And I think almost conspiracy-like that if we can just focus these people around humanitarian, then we're all right. You know, and you know, I ain't got no evidence to back that, but you can see where I'm, that's what I'm trying
to... Well, it's a fascinating point that you raise about these wider approaches, this theory of change that you talk about, because in effect you're saying that even if 20% was spent on humanitarian and 80% was divvied up, you know, in various ways to deal with the wider problems surrounding that humanitarian disaster, I suppose your argument is that that may actually make the 20% go far further.
100%. 100%. 100%. Exactly. Yeah. That if how are you going to enable? So I'm not saying Islamic Relief should change what they're doing. Almost a major. They are humanitarian organizations, continue to do humanitarian work.
Yeah.
But now their trucks are stopped at the border. What effort has the Muslim Ummah put together individually and collectively? Individually and collectively, to aid the opening of those borders, what have we got in place? I'd say almost zero, like zero. You know, do any of our charities put 5% aside, 1% aside for lobbying? You understand? You know, who have we got on board that we can pick up the phone to and say, hey, you know what? We'd like to put our name to this thing. And by the way, you can see in the current situation. Anyway, I think it's probably better not to be. But even if we have put our name to something, it's almost insignificant. You know,
so
we have no influence there whatsoever. And then what I'd add to that is then we complain that the media is controlled. The media is controlled, but no one's donating anything to things. One thing I fundamentally believe, a very good friend of mine who runs a charity that is working to think. To try to address some of this stuff. It mentioned to me once, and I absolutely believe it, that any of the tools that are available to quote unquote the other side are available to Muslims.
Really?
Are available to Muslims. Whether you want to call that the media, whether you want to call that charity work, the lobbying, all of these things are available to Muslims.
Yeah. So let's tackle that head on, because this is quite, I'll be honest with you, I'm probably a recent convert to what you're saying. In fact, it's probably you that convinced me on that demo that we were walking through a few weeks back, that we've got a very narrow conception of charity in our community, and in a way that's holding us back. So let's talk about advocacy work. You've worked in Oxfam and British Red Cross, and I notice that these charities do a lot of work on educating. They do a lot of work on exposing poverty from a statistical perspective, from a propaganda perspective. And that's pretty effective. I mean, the Oxfam, you know, X number of people have half the world's wealth. That goes around, and that's a really effective way of expressing the inequalities that exist in the world. And of course, that takes a lot of effort.
It does,
So that's a really structured effort. Do we see any analogous type of activity in any of the big Muslim charity sectors?
No. Dedicated advocacy resources, I think, are almost...
How much do they dedicate to advocacy, for, say, Oxfam?
I mean, none, I think. I mean, you can't... There are some charities that have employed... Even Muslim Aid, we have employed or we did employ an individual, maybe two, that would do some of this work. But as regards an established, structured advocacy department, remit, mandate, I don't think it exists. I think it doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
So we might turn up at the climate conference, right, with a table. Right. So I think that you know, and we have done, or some of the charities have done.
Yeah.
But a sustained advocacy group looking out for the issues that we are passionate about, that we are collecting money for, that we are raising funds for, campaigns around, our very existence is built around. We're not doing that. And they are effective. I mean, I remember when I was at Oxfam, we had this statistic about the one that you mentioned, and I think it was like 80%. If you put them, you could fit them all on a single decker bus or a double decker bus or something like that.
Yeah.
And they mentioned that the statistic at Davos, right? That they got stage and made Davos. So you these kind of things do open up with diplomacy. Most of the larger charities, their CEOs or their leaderships, most of their time is doing what? They're not going around fundraising. Do you understand? They're attending these events. They're making friends. They're, they're getting invited to these things so that they can then carry that message on to that stage. We don't tend to get invited to those stages. And the truth is because we don't invest in it in our charities. So I think it's wrong. I think sometimes we're playing this victim thing, oh, you know what, we won't get that stage. Well, how much have we actually invested or educated our communities to say that, look, this is an important thing that we need to be doing. So pay us to do that work instead of feeding that orphan. And that's a hard call to make. But if you're brave enough to make it, the right people will give money to you. And then you'll get that stage. And then you say, if after doing that, and then someone refuses you that stage, I think then you can kind of, oh, you know what, they're refusing our thing. But we're not even on the first step. We haven't tied our camel, and then we start complaining that we don't get that exposure.
So let me get this. Let me try to connect these things. So for example, as you know, I've been working on sort of Muslim vote initiatives around the country and speaking to different communities. And inevitably, you come across really intelligent political operators within the Muslim community. Have got a lot of experience. Maybe they were previously in the Labour Party or whoever. And they've got a lot of experience, and they've become disillusioned, say, with the mainstream parties. And most of them that I've noticed are working for the mainstream charity sector or for advocacy in the mainstream. And I've always commented to them, well, why don't you work within the Muslim community? Maybe set up an organization and bring you guys together. And their answer is the Muslims will never pay for it. We will never. That type of long-term thinking just doesn't exist. And we will never have like a credible stream of money, you know, for the next 5 years to leave our jobs to work in. Your point is we've got to think about charity, in inverted commas, in a far broader way. And we've got to convince the Muslim community here to act differently.
Absolutely. And it does require education. It's hard, and you're absolutely right. People don't want to pay for that stuff, or at least the community. There are elements of change. I mean, even the initiative that you speak about, and others, MEND and others, that are involved in trying to change that narrative. But I mean, even before, look at organizations like CAGE or HUGS. I mean, have continuously been attacked, have continuously been shut down, and you would argue that those are critical parts of Allah Subhanahu wa Ta'ala's narrative on where we should be giving our money, but they've always found it hard to raise money because they're associated with anti-terrorism laws and people are afraid that they might get labelled if they send their tenor over. I mean, that's the other thing. A lot of us think, you know, we're more important than we actually are. Is that, you know, if I send my, you know, 20 quid over to them, I'm going to get labelled and I'm going to be thrown in prison. And it's like, you know, we're just not that important. most of us are just not that important for anyone to come after us or label us. But you're right. Fundamentally, I believe that there's an education to take place in our communities that, look, giving money is great, and we are immensely appreciative as a sector of how much money we get. And on, like I said, on the whole, and I can't think of any real example where we don't do our best to get that money to where it's supposed to go to. But if you are expecting our condition or the condition of the Muslim woman, quite frankly, to change by you giving the way that we are giving and have been giving in the past, then that needs to be corrected. It can't be. And the example you gave is a good one. Why isn't the Muslim Vote Initiative, as an example, where we know categorically that your local MP has said that, you know what, a ceasefire is not a good idea in Gaza right now. We believe the killing should continue, right? Literally, right? That it's not bad enough yet. So we don't think, and it's going to be worse if we stop the killing. They categorically have said this. He's coming up for election. You have the majority in that council or in that constituency to be able to make a possible impact to remove this person, but you're not willing to donate towards that initiative. You're not willing to work towards that initiative, so that your humanitarian aid, the place where you did give your £50 to, is going to be sitting in that truck on the border, not getting through because you decided that, you know what, this Muslim is not worth my money, or, oh no, it doesn't make a difference anyway. I mean, it's just so counterintuitive. that, I mean, I don't know what else to say. Some of these things are enablers so that you can do that other stuff. And yeah. And I think we need to re-educate ourselves and our communities, our families, whoever, our parents, that look, if you want to continue doing what you want to do and save these orphans, save these widows, save the humanitarian, then we're going to have to work on this side. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, slowly, slowly, that's going to get shut down. And they have. Look what happened. Look what happened. I mean, as soon as the ICJ ruling came out, I mean, the very next day, we shut down UNRWA.
Yeah.
That's how easy it was. And where were we positioned as a community to stop that from happening? We, like, zero, right? So,
I mean, maybe this is an unfair question, but do you think we are different to, say, the American Muslim scene, where obviously they've got much more money, probably, certainly do have in the US, but they do seem to be building broader institutions, and we can debate the effectiveness of it. And, you know, I think that's a fair thing. But British Muslims, we tend to give for these emergencies and give a lot of money, whereas they're thinking about the long term. Is that a unfair
comparison? I think overall, the charity sector, especially the Muslim charity sector, generally is more on the emergency side, even in the States.
Right.
So I think there is definitely, I don't know if I know enough, to be honest. You're right. I mean, I spent like 13 years working there, not in the charity sector, before moving into the charity sector.
Yeah.
And there are really good examples of infrastructure, institutions. I was listening to a podcast the other day, I think it was like the first, like, for example, mental health institution set up for Muslims,
right.
By Muslim psychiatrists, to address like the thing, and apparently it's the first one. I don't know if it is, but you know, that's what it said. Mm-hmm. So I think, yes, you're right. There probably is more examples of that in the States than we have here. Mm-hmm. But I think the more problematic thing for me is, we're not even looking at setting those kind of things up.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not just they've got one, we haven't got one.
Yeah.
Is it because do we have a mentality as a community to even think about those things, or are we still stuck in, you know, should we make our mosques bigger and our schools bigger and these kind of things?
Now, before I met you, I don't know why I'm describing this as a pivotal moment in my life, but before I met you, I used to have, and I think a lot of Muslims have this, that I'm going to give to charities that have 100%, you know, donation policy. You're laughing. I suppose my question is, am I being pure when I say that? And I'm being sincere to the fiqh of giving in charity, or is this just an irrational way to view charity?
Pivotal moment. I mean, you put me. I thought it was pivotal when I met you in that cafe in South London.
But, you know, it's a big moment. Big moment.
Look, it's asked all the time. I think we're all intelligent enough to know that if I'm giving £100 to anything, to any charity, it costs money to get that £100 to where it needs to get to. I don't think anyone believes, quite frankly, that that can be done for free, right? The problem we have is, or the problem with that question, or the answer to that question is, whether you're covering that cost from your own pocket or some other means, that we should be transparent enough to the donor to let them know that It's not because this is free, i.e. this is not costing us anything to get here, and we're more efficient than any other charity on this planet, because you're not. Yeah. What you're saying is you're covering that cost somewhere else, and you should let people know where you're covering that cost from. Because when another charity comes along, that might be better or worse, it doesn't matter, and says, you know what, we're going to take 10% out of this or 20% out of this to deliver your 80 pence to this place, suddenly people are comparing, oh, you know what, but the other guys are doing this 100%, thinking that they're more efficient. I mean, I'm saying that that's not a a accurate conclusion because they've said 100% that they're more efficient. They're two very different things.
Yeah.
It could be costing them 80p to deliver that pound for you. They're just covering that 80p themselves. Whereas the other charity is saying that, look, we're telling you that this is costing us 20 pence to deliver your 80p, and this is what we're getting out of your 80p. And do you get my point? So efficiency now, who's more efficient? The guys that are telling you that it's 20p. That's efficiency, right? Number one. Number two, why are you comparing? It's not the 100% you should be focused around. What are you getting for your pound? So, you know, when you do qurbanis, right, every year, mm-hmm. what are you looking at? I want to do a qurbani. So I've chosen Palestine, right? Or let's say that you've chosen Palestine. You've chosen to give your qurbani in Palestine. By the way, advice is you can do more than one qurbani. Do you understand? Do the right thing. Mm-hmm. Qurbani at home, do one qurbani abroad. That's what you should be doing. Like, you know, if you're talking about charity at home, that's where it should start. If there's poor people in your country, which there always is, you can do a qurbani in the UK and you can do one abroad. So, you know, it's not like, again, this either or thing. But anyway, that's a different question. But you're looking at doing a qurbani in Pakistan or Kashmir or whatever. And someone puts out that they can do it for 29 quid and someone else says 35 quid and 70 quid. And you're like, oh, well, those are guys doing it 70 quid. I'm just going to do it for the one that's doing it for 29.
Yes.
You are being unfair, right? If that decision is purely being made on what is the lowest amount I can spend to feed or to fulfill this obligation, I mean, I think we need to seriously consider what our intention is of giving this charity money away. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was never a criteria that was used to give charity is what is the cheapest way I can fulfill this obligation, you know? And I think this is unfortunately, some of it is obviously to do with the marketing of our charities, fair enough. But some of it has to do with our own individual nafs and how we've interpreted, again, helping our brothers and sisters or the way in which we've interpreted Islam to be this so narrow focus. Is, okay, what is that? Why are the guys that are charging 70? Why are they charging 70? If the other charity is saying 29 and these guys are 70, that's like more than twice as much. What are they doing? Well, actually, you know what? They're not just slaughtering an animal. And they're not just like, you know, putting the meat. They're actually saying that, look, you know what? We are going to take care of the entire welfare of this family for a month, right? So that they don't have to come back to us next year. I don't know. Whatever the reason is.
Yeah.
But I think we're intelligent to know that it costs something to deliver that cash. Do you understand? And at the very least, I think, and you know, you can come back to me and you say, gosh, you know what? Am I supposed to ask all these questions before I give away this thing? Yeah. No, you don't have to ask all these questions. But I think just like you would go and, you know, we just bought coffee before this podcast and you want to get what you want for your money. And that was only a couple of quid. Mm-hmm. Whereas you're prepared to give away 50, 60 quid or 100 quid or 1,000 pound or a couple of 1,000 pound and not ask anything about what the impact of that money is. I think, you know, we're just, and then evaluate it accordingly. I'm willing to pay 50p more for a certain cup of coffee because I believe the taste is better. It comes from a certain source, might be ethical, organic. Yeah. For 50p, I'm willing to go through those things in my head. Mm. But when we're giving a donation, we're like, no, you know what? Why should I ask all these questions? Yeah. At the very least, I would say, how are you fulfilling this? How are you fulfilling this? If I'm giving you £100, how are you delivering my money? You know, who's fulfilling this? Is Jalal paying for my £100 to be delivered? Because I think Jalal should know whether he's paying to a 20%. So I don't think it's a direct indication of how efficient a charity is. I think it would be fairer on the donor to know how they are fulfilling that cost, number one. And number two, rather than comparing it on cost on the donor side, they should ask the question, okay, you know what do I get out of that 70 quid versus 29?
So, you know, what you're effectively saying, Kashif, is like any form of ibadat, we need to think more deeply about
Amazing.
We need to think about the outcomes that come out of it, not just the actions that we undertake, like salah, like fasting.
Perfect.
We think about the outcomes. One final question, Ben, for you, Kashif. I mean, imagine, I can imagine that we've got a lot of high network
net worth individuals who watch this show, Inshallah Ta'ala.
Inshallah.
You know, if they wanted to, they've understood this, they get it. You know, maybe historically they've been putting money just into a charity. Just is the wrong word, actually. They've been putting money into humanitarian work. Now they want to change and think more deeply about the outcomes. Like, just give me some of the advice that you would give to them. Like, you meet these guys, right? What would you say to them?
What I've started saying to them is I would look at their portfolio of giving just like they would look at their investment portfolios. When you're building up an investment portfolio, I mean, you've had some of the, mashallah, our brothers that deal in this stuff on the show. I don't know if they have been on the show, but you know, you build up an investment portfolio, low risk, high risk, and then you say, okay, you know what, I'm going to put 20% in these shares and these companies, I'm going to invest in property. And you put all this thought process into building up this portfolio of giving. Portfolio of investing. And I would say to them, just like you put your effort and strategic mind and all of that insight into building that portfolio, talk to a specialist like me or someone like me who knows about that sector. Just like you would do, speak to an investment advisor on there and say, hey, you know what? I've got this fund. I'm setting up a foundation. I want to give away this money. Help me build up this portfolio where first I can have the impact in the areas I want, and no problem choosing. If you're inclined to domestic abuse or solving the problem of then let's look at the charities that are working in that sector. Yeah. What does it actually take to solve this problem in this region, in this country? Do you want to solve the domestic abuse problem in the whole of Africa or Kenya or just a town in Pakistan maybe? Do you understand? What is your mandate? What would you like to be involved in? Because you can choose. You can choose. Right. That's your prerogative. Yeah. But when it comes to how you want to solve that, sit down with an expert and let them plan out that portfolio just like you would do with everything else. Mm-hmm. And say that, okay, you know what? To solve that problem, we need to make this alliance with this government ministry. Right? Because they're the ones that make the law. They're the ones that punish the people when they get done for this stuff and too many of them get off. You understand? So we need some lobbying group there. And you know what? There's a hostel we can build over here for those people that are trying to run away. Because we need to isolate them from their abusers and their families. We're going to need a place to stay. We can put some money there. And you know what? Some of these people have children. They still need to be educated. So let's put some aside for building a school or funding sponsorships or scholarships to put their women their children into these things. Let's sit down and build those portfolios out so that giving, first of all, has the impact that you want it to have. And I won't finish off with example, but once I was helping this founder, high net worth individual, set up his foundation, and they'd been giving millions, tens of thousands of scholarships in India, right? Mostly Muslims, but giving in India. And through university, so 3-4 years through university, some of them were doctors, dentists, engineers, etc.
Yeah.
Now, I went there. I went there to evaluate the program and stuff. And what we were finding when you ran the numbers, no one had run the numbers. I ran the numbers.
Yeah.
What happened to those people after they were leaving university? Most of them were not getting the jobs. And now there was Modi's government was there, like there was, you know, Muslims getting into government jobs especially was a bit tough, etc. But what you would see is that most of them, you'd invested like 20, 30 grand getting them through the university programs. And at the end, it could have cost you only 500 quid to get them a surgery or a dentist chair. And they could have had their own dentistry. But because your program stopped at, so that whole 30 grand has gone down the drain. Because no one looked into what they called the last mile. What would it have cost to get that thing over the line and get this person a job? And it's up there. Now, as someone who's giving away so much money, you want to know how you can make that impact. And quite frankly, you need to speak to experts that need to do that. And you need to sit down and build that portfolio out so you can do or get to the place that you want to get to quicker, cheaper, more efficiently. And just look at it a little bit more strategically than just giving money away. And then, quite frankly, normally, especially high net worth people, they'll give it away. They'll be upset because whoever they're giving to didn't achieve the objectives they do. And because they're so successful in whatever they've made their money from, they normally break off and then they'll say, oh, I'm just going to set up my own foundation now and, you know, bring someone in like me and help them set it up. I mean, I would rather they carry on giving to people that are specialists, but, you know, unfortunately, that's the cycle they get into and stuff.
It's really been a fascinating conversation today. Jazakallah khair. Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
Please remember to subscribe to our social media and YouTube channels and head over to our website, thinkinmuslim.com, to sign up to my weekly newsletter. Jazakallah khair.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.